Hello, my name is John Smetanka, and the name of our program is With Respect. Our guest today on With Respect is Elaine Beetz. Elaine is an author of a genre called cozy mysteries, which is absolutely fascinating when I got into it and learned something about it. She has written many books from different perspectives about murder. I hate to call her a murder lady, but we'll get a little bit about that later. So, With Respect, Elaine Beetz, we'll be right back. Elaine, how are you this morning?
I'm fine, John. How are you?
I am fantastic. It is good to have sun around in my community, which unfortunately is sort of a premium these days. But you're in Fort Lauderdale, which disgustingly has sun all the time, don't you?
We do. In fact, well, the last 4 days we've had rain, which is not characteristic, but the sun is shining. I live right on the intracoastal. I'm watching the boats speed by me. And so, yes, it is an absolutely gorgeous day.
All right. Now that I'm completely miserable because I'm sitting in a studio which doesn't have any view of the sun and of the canal, the intercoastal, and the ocean, I'm jealous, all right?
There you go. Okay, good.
All right, so where are you from originally?
I'm from St. Louis, Missouri, so I'm a Midwestern girl, and my husband and I lived in Washington, D.C. for a little bit, and then we wound up in Fort Lauderdale about 15 years ago.
Well, let's see, where did you come from in the St. Louis area? Because I do have a number of friends down there. Whereabouts in St. Louis?
I lived in South St. Louis near Tower Grove Park, which is the old German section of the city, and St. Louis is now a very diverse city, which greatly improved the food. I grew up German, and I'm not that crazy about sauerkraut. But they brought in a lot of Thai and Vietnamese and Hispanics, and generally sparked up the dinner time.
Oh, that is good. I remember I spent some time in London. In fact, I've been there a number of times. And when I first started going to London, it was bizarre. There was nothing in terms of good food. And I was told when I first went there, if you want a good hamburger, you go to the two places. One was the Great American Disaster, and the other one was, what was it? It's the Hard Rock Cafe. And that was the first, I guess one of the first ones was in London off Green Park. So and they were right, absolutely right. Those were the only two good hamburgers I had all the time I was there.
And I'm Isn't it funny how I don't eat hamburger that much when I'm at home, but when I'm in a foreign country, all of a sudden, I want a hamburger.
Yeah, it's true. Well, anyway, where'd you go to school? What were your interests when you went to school?
I went to the University of Missouri in their journalism school, and I was a newspaper reporter for the St. Louis Post-Dispatch for 27 years and a syndicated columnist for United Media in New York. And then the newspaper business sort of tanked, and I got out of it and started writing novels full-time.
Well, all right. Where did you get the interest? How about your parents and any siblings? Do you have any siblings?
I have two brothers who are still alive. My parents, unfortunately, are long gone, and this makes me the oldest person in my family, which makes me very nervous.
It happened to me. I know the feeling. It's scary.
But I think I got my storytelling ability from my grandfather. And if you grew up in an old German neighborhood like I did, the bars were the social clubs, and you didn't go there to get drunk. You went there to meet your family, to have a beer, to relax, to get out of the house away from the kids. And Grandpa was a great barroom storyteller. He wasn't malicious. He was just funny. And he had a very, very dry wit. And I think that's where I got my storytelling ability.
You know, one of the things that, that many of us have had, and I confess to this, I love to listen to older people tell stories. I've learned so much about history and about culture and about humanity from just sitting and listening to people who have experiences that that went before me. Of course, when I was a, it was easier when I was a kid. Now I'm a bit older, and those folks are not telling me stories anymore. But it is. I remember sitting at the feet of my grandfather and a friend of mine's grandfather, and just listening to them tell stories about the old days. And it's wonderful. It's absolutely wonderful.
It is, and you know, I think the greatest gift that you can give your family, is to tell them about your history. Tell them about your ordinary history, where you went to school, what it was like. My grandparents, my grandfather was one of 11 children, and my grandmother was one of 13. They quit school in the fourth grade and went to work in a factory. They got married at 16 on their lunch hour. And these were little facts I picked up, but I never really got to sit down with them and ask them, what did you feel like when you had to leave school? What was it like to go work at a factory in the fourth grade? All I knew was they had a hard time getting a job because in those days, a lot of the factories hung out signs that said, no Irish and no Catholics. And these are things now that are lost. They're lost forever. So even though it sounds ordinary to you, tell your grandkids about your first car. Tell them about school. Tell them about the teacher you liked. Tell them about the ones you didn't. They're going to need this someday.
You know, that is a very wise piece of advice. I learned, as I said, from those two grandfathers, grandfatherly characters. And but you know, when I went, when I became a father and had a daughter, and I also watched other people in our office with their kids and heard their problems and talking to their kids about the old days, there was a period of time in their growth when they just had no interest. They had no interest in hearing about what their ancestors did or their grandfathers or, you know, whatever. But it comes later. At some point, you're right, there is a hunger to find out where people have come from. You know, who am I? You know, I always say that maybe this is an old phrase somebody else came up with, but if you don't know where you came from and you don't know who you are, you aren't going to know where you're going.
It's absolutely true. It may be a cliche, but it is absolutely true. And the past will shape your future.
There's a friend of mine, actually an investigator who worked for me when I was a prosecutor, and he was an older investigator, but he had been born in Russia before the Russian Revolution. His father was a prime dancer for ballerina, famous ballerina, back in the Imperial Ballet. And when the revolution came, he was 6 years old and remembered some of the living in Moscow. His father and mother were in the ballet scene even after the revolution. He was sent out to England. They smuggled him out, and then eventually they came and rescued him. But the story goes on and on and on, and his Anna Pavlova was her name, was the name of the dancer. And the stories that he could tell were amazing. one day I was in his house and he got very melancholy and he said, John, I've got two sons and they are, you know, teenagers. And he walked me through his memorabilia, and he had cabinets and cabinets of awards and medals and pictures and programs from her, from the history of her, his father, their grandfather. And he said, John, they don't pay attention. They're not interested. And he said, it's devastating. What, when I die, what do I do with this? And I had no answer for him. Well, the answer came somewhat later, because the two kids who were sort of on the wild side when they were teenagers, one became a police officer out in California, the other became a dentist out in California, and they sat down with Andy and probed his mind and got all those memories. And so it wasn't lost. Somewhere out there, these two kids are now able to pass those marvelous memories down to their kids. And, so this is extremely important, I think, to all parents and grandparents. I think your advice is wonderful. But, okay, you started to write. Why did you write? What was the big deal? I mean, I assume you're a storyteller, but that doesn't mean that, that you're going to be a writer.
Well, there wasn't much else I was good at. I went to school, I went to Catholic school, and I know everybody makes jokes about the nuns, but I had really enlightened nuns, and they steered me into a career of, they wanted me to write for a newspaper, and they told me to go to college. And when I was growing up in Florissant, Missouri, this was a big deal. You weren't supposed, women weren't supposed to go to college. I was supposed to get married and have six kids. And so for them to steer me into college was radical, and bless them for it. And so I did. My parents agreed to send me to college, but they only wanted to send me to a Catholic college, which turned out ladies. And I was no lady. I knew early on I was not going to be a lady. So I worked my way through through school, proofreading medical books, and for C.V. Mosby, and that I made a vast amount of money for the time. I think I made 40 cents more than minimum wage, and it was enough to pay my way through the University of Missouri. I also did, what was that? Oh, the other thing I did, which I really liked, was Missouri Supreme Court briefs.
Oh.
And I still remember reading the case about the murder of the pig ear sandwich man.
Oh, my God.
And it turns out he didn't have pig's ears. What he sold were pig's ear sandwiches. Which is a delicacy in a lot of African-American neighborhoods. And so I still remember reading it, that court case.
There is an opinion in Michigan court history which is written in the meter and the whole rhyme. Every single word of it is written in the same meter as, I think that I shall never see a poem lovely as a tree. And it was about saving a tree. The whole case was in the Court of Appeals, Michigan Court of Appeals, and the whole case was about saving this tree from being torn down, chopped down by some developers. And I don't even remember how it turned out, whether they saved the tree or they didn't. But it was a unique opinion, which I see quoted periodically. But, you know, that's a... actually a good discipline to get into that sort of writing, because the two types of writing that you talked about are not terribly exciting, except they're good discipline. And then you add to that your ability to tell stories. Wow.
Well, the other thing about being a reporter is that it prepares you if you want to be a novelist, and because you learn a lot about dialogue. What does a reporter do? They report what people say.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, they get it right. But the thing about it is, they learn to report the gist of what people say. Mm-hmm. You don't want anyone to report you accurately, because then you get in all the uhs and the does and where mm-hmm. you wander off the topic. A reporter gets it concise and quick, and so that teaches, it's training. It's good training for dialogue if you're going to be a novelist. And the other thing is, you respect deadlines, because that is the ultimate sin in journalism, turning in a story late. Mm-hmm. And I mm-hmm. used to have an old school editor who said, get it done. Nobody's going to put compliments of a friend in that blank space. It's not a high school program. So I learned to turn it in on time.
We're going to take a break right now. We're talking to Elaine Veitz, who is a fascinating person and a writer of significance, because she has turned out murder after murder after murder. She is probably the murder lady of St. Louis and Fort Lauderdale. We'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Elaine Veitz, who is the author of a new book called The Art of Murder, as if murder needs to be put into an art form. This is John Smetanka. So, Elaine, so what got you, you've got this, you had this wonderful background as a columnist, the United group of columnists is well-respected around the country, around the world. And you were the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, which is one of the great newspapers, or was one of the great newspapers in the country. And then you, all of a sudden, you start turning out novels, for pity's sakes. What brought that about?
Well, what brought it about was I got fired.
Oh, that, and, you know, that really helps.
It does.
It focuses your thinking.
And in my profession, very much like radio, it's considered an honor to be fired. You must have been doing something right if you got bounced. So I got fired, and I was really at a loss. I mean, I'm joking about it now, but it wasn't funny. And I didn't know what to do with myself. And so, being German, I went in for recreational cleaning, and I started cleaning. We were living in a townhouse in Washington, D.C., and I started cleaning everything. I mean, I even took a sharp knife and got the wax buildup in the corners.
Wow.
And my husband was afraid to walk across the rug, because I would follow him with the vacuum cleaner and vacuum. You know, the cats ran from me because I was cleaning up after them. And one winter day, the plaster ceiling fell in the dining room. And so we needed a plaster. And he shows up at the door, and I look at his boots, and I go, "You've got dust on your boots." And I got down and shined them.
Oh, my God.
And when I was on my knees, I thought, okay, you're either going to clean for a living, or you're going to find something else to do, because you have gone right around the bend. So at that point, I wrote a series. I wrote my first mystery, which was set in a newspaper, and I managed to kill off all my editors.
Naturally. And, that's the best
thinly revenge. Disguised, or actually fatly disguised, and then I found an agent, and it's actually, if you're writing a book, harder to find an agent than it is a publisher, but I found a good agent, and he told me how to rewrite the book, and he sold it, and that was my first mystery. It was called Backstab, and I just completed my 30th mystery. But along
it's
the way,
too bad that you've turned that German hard work ethic away from cleaning your house and into writing.
Well, it pays better and it's much easier on the hands.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
The Francesca series, the first series, the newspaper series, lasted for 4 books. And then I was out of work. The publisher simply cancel the entire imprint. And I was devastated because I saw myself as Sue Grafton writing 30 books in this series, and it didn't happen. And my agent said, look, it's over. You need a new idea. And I said, but I've got a proposal for the next in this series. And he said, it's dead. And I said, but, and he said, it's dead.
Put a stake in it, sweetie.
It's over, okay? Gone. So I started working at a bookstore, and it was a Barnes & Noble in Hollywood, Florida, where we were living then. And I thought that a bookstore, we would just discuss books, you know, with people. And that was hard labor, really hard labor. And
That's interesting. Why?
Well, each book weighs about a pound, a hardcover, and there are thousands of books, and people read them and leave them all over the store. And so you have to, you know, put them away, and or they leave them in some place strange. We were always finding the Kama Sutra in the pregnancy section. I have no idea why. But so I'm hauling books on a floor that's not carpeted, and that leaves you tired. It, you know, and putting them away and bending and stooping. But the other thing was that because maybe this was Florida, the customers were just weird. And so we had these two women come up, and they were buying a book of spells, and they were wearing the Wiccan symbols, and I thought, you know, if I was buying a book of spells, would I buy them at Barnes & Noble? But anyway, I'm trying to ring them up, and I've jammed the cash register. So I turned to the guy next to me, and I said, David, I've jammed the cash register. And he says, okay, do this. So I punched these buttons, and I said, it's double jammed, and if they turn me into a frog, it's your fault. And he goes, no, I know somebody at another bookstore, and she undoes spells.
Oh, no.
But the customers were just, there was another guy who came in, and he throws a $7 paperback down and says, this one's $7, I'm returning it for that one, and I'm out of here. And I said, no, I've got to get the manager's approval. It's, you know, you just can't do that. And he says, you're an idiot. And I said, yes, sir, but I need the manager's approval.
Yeah, that's why I need the manager's approval.
And so I'm on the intercom going, manager to the front. And he says, you're a moron. I said, yes, sir. And so he keeps telling me how stupid I am. And this woman behind him finally says, I hate it when people don't take their medication. And the woman behind her goes, rude people stink. And all the women in this line started talking about how terrible this man was. And finally the manager did come to the front, and he slunk out. And then the nice woman in front says to me, you're doing a good job, honey. You hang in there. And I thought, this is a book. You know, this is all of these stories are a book. And so I put them together, and the book was, and I came up with the idea for a series where each book I would work a different low-paying job. And that one became Murder Between the Covers, and The Art of Murder is the 15th book in that series.
Now, when you see it, you call them the Dead End Job series. Now, that's an interesting concept. Most people would have a nervous breakdown if they had to, work in a dead end job from 20 of them, or whatever it is, the number that you've done. Each one of them is not an attractive thing to do, but you're making it into an art form.
Well, I was kind of a job tourist. I knew I wouldn't have to work these jobs forever. What impressed me, though, were the people who did have to work these jobs and how good-humored they stayed. I think the worst job that I ever did became Dying to Call You. And for that one, I was a telemarketer, and I sold septic tank cleaner. And I beg you, do not be mean to a telemarketer. because nobody says, I want to be a telemarketer when I grow up. You're in that job because something terrible happened to you.
Yeah.
But there I was with this horrible, horrible job, and everyone hating me and cursing me and screaming at me. And I worked next to a woman who owed $3,000 in medical bills. And she was working three jobs. She was a telemarketer. She had a day job. And then in her spare time, and she actually said in her spare time, she cleaned houses. And she was the kindest woman I've ever met. I mean, fate was really bad to her. But somehow this woman was cheerful and a good person. And I was lost in admiration for someone who could do this and who could survive like this.
You know, you're painting a picture of an author who is out rubbing shoulders and cleaning shoes of people who are working honest and difficult and maybe boring jobs, okay? And you're learning about human nature, and you're learning that just because you're in a difficult situation, a difficult point in someone's life, does not diminish their humanity. And in reading this book, The Art of Murder, it was fascinating to see a number of those characters that you have that aura, that sense of hey, they're decent people, even though they're doing something strange, or what I would consider strange. And this fits in with the mantra of our show. For example, we have found, I've done about 500 shows here, and of the 500, I think there was five people in the 500 who started off knowing at age six what they wanted to do and going on a straight line, no deviation, no problems, no nothing, to becoming a star, whatever it is they've done, opera, acting, whatever. Most of us, myself included, did zigzags all over the place. And you're describing a world of zigzags in your career, that sometimes there are things that knock you down, things that pick you up, things, you know, a telephone call, you meet an off conversation with somebody that turns into a marriage, people get divorces, and all of that, I say, makes people more interesting. This is what makes people interesting, is the zigs and zags, not necessarily the driven nature that some people have. I don't know, what are your thoughts on that?
Well, I agree with that, and, you know, I also agree, excuse me, with that old line of life is what's happening when you're making plans. You have no control over the strange things that are going to happen in your life. So all you can do is try to be flexible enough to use them to your advantage, and to see what, you know, we talked about the past informing the present. You know, my grandfather quit his job when he was in his 50s because he was a supervisor and one of his men was unfairly fired. And my grandmother lost her, and my grandparents lost that house, their house, over that grand gesture. And because at 50 in those days, you could not get another job. And so he went to work. And he had a confectionery, a little, you know, neighborhood place, and he and my grandmother spent the rest of their life working 7 days a week. So he was a man of iron integrity, but he lost so much. And that was why he kept saying to me, you must go to college, you must go to college. And he was right, because when the bad times happened, it's much easier for me with a college degree to get a job and survive and adapt than it was for him who never got past the fourth grade.
Mm-hmm. Well, I tell you what, the people who are listening should take solace from your career and your life, because the things that happened to you, and we're going to talk about some of those things, just made you a better understander and conveyor of human nature and making good stories. And we're going to talk about cozy mysteries and how they fit in, but my congratulations to you on this. We're going to take another break right now. When we come back, we're going to talk about this, the art of murder, but also about the concept of cozy murders. Because I love cozy murders. It's so neat. It sounds great, and they actually are great. This is John Smetanka. We're on With Respect, and we'll be right back. We're now back on With Respect with Elaine Veets, who is an author of 30, that's 3-0, novels, murder mysteries, and bodies are dying all over the place whenever she gets her computer going. And this is John Smetanka, and we're on With Respect, as I said. Elaine, when we broke, I mentioned the phrase cozy mysteries. What's a cozy mystery?
A cozy mystery is a mystery very similar to Agatha Christie, who, by the way, I greatly respect and admire. But they are mysteries that do not have a lot of sex. They do not have a lot of blood and violence. I mean, obviously people die, but they die off stage. And they're also traditional mysteries, which is what my Dead End Job series is. And in addition to being cozy, and a traditional mystery, the clues are planted. There's a lot of red herrings. In a good mystery, it's hard to spot the clues, but they're there. And you want to play fair with your audience, all the while hoping they never catch you. And so the Dead End Job series is a cozy, traditional mystery, and The Art of Murder is set at a museum in Fort Lauderdale, a real museum called the Bonnet House. And the Bonnet House was owned by two artists, and it was built in the 1920s. And I'm not a big fan of house museums. Usually, I don't want to pay $20 to look at some rich guy's furniture. But I really liked Bonnet House, and it was owned by artists. It was full of life, color. They didn't just accumulate things. They enjoyed life, and they wanted to share their charmed life with future generations. So you've got 35 acres in the heart of Fort Lauderdale, and, you know, it's surrounded by trashy T-shirt shops and all the tourist stuff. But it's got a view of the ocean. It's got wonderful, wonderful plants and trees. You can bring your camera there. And they have some of the original owner's pet monkeys. She's got Brazilian squirrel monkeys. And Evelyn Bartlett, who was one of the owners, loved her monkeys. And they still live outside in the treetops. And you can photograph them. And there was a tourist there one day, and he was looking at the monkeys, and he said, so there's three left. Are you going to breed them? And they said, oh, we're sorry. It's three males. And he says, what about artificial insemination? And his wife goes, George, how did you get two children? But it was fun there. And for that dead-end job, it was a volunteer job, and I worked as a greeter. So basically, I just said, welcome to Bonnet House, and handed people a map. But I got to use the walkie-talkie, which is really cool. Walkie-talkies make everybody 8 years old.
Yeah, it's the Secret Service thing. Talk into your lapel. A friend of mine in England is a docent at Waddesdon House, which is a large mansion. And I got to tell you that I've been through a lot of castles and monuments and museums, and I know exactly what you're saying about going through people's homes. If they've got, you know, their family looking down at you from the walls, you know, going back 10 generations, And then you've got his dark paneling, and it's just kind of, it's boring. But that particular place, I saw it at Christmas time, and Sue took me through, and it was fascinating. It was alive. They had all kinds of interesting decorations and whatnot. It was a totally alive place. But, you know, so this, I'm now, the next time we go to Fort Lauderdale, I'm going to have to try this place out.
You really should. And, you know, spend the whole day. If you don't like to walk, there's a little tram that'll take you around. Bring your camera. There's wonderful photographs. And Evelyn was married to Frederick Clay Bartlett, but Evelyn lived to be 109, and she drank she grew the Rangpur limes on the grounds for her favorite cocktail, which was Rangpur limes, maple syrup, and Mount Gay rum. And all I can figure out is that it must have been a health drink, because when you make it to 109, and she didn't just sit in a rocking chair. I mean, at age 101, she took up collecting miniature orchids. So she really lived to the fullest, to the very end of her life, which is admirable.
You know, getting into that book of the Art of Murder, I haven't read any of your other books, but I can tell you that there were touches there which put me into what I thought, well, this is Fort Lauderdale society, not tourist society, but the resident society. And I thought, you know, this strikes a bell. For example, in the back of my head somewhere, I had some aunts and uncles who lived in Florida and retired down there, and they had talked about Sunset Salute. And I thought, what the hell are you talking about? And I thought, oh, this is a joke. And then I read about Sunset Salutes are a ritual, like British tea in the afternoon. At least the way you describe it. Is this accurate?
Sunset Salutes are indeed. When my husband and I were deciding whether to move to Florida, we weren't sure that we could stand living in there, because everybody goes, oh, it's Florida, it's so hot, and it is. So we decided that we would spend August, the entire month of August, living in Fort Lauderdale. And if we could stand that, then we could move there. And fortunately, there were no hurricanes that August. But we lived in this little compound, and there were a lot of boaters who live aboards, who dock their boats there. And everybody would come home from work, and at 6 o'clock or so, they would gather around the pool, and they'd all have a drink, and they'd all talk about their day and salute it. And they became good friends, even though we all moved away from that place. So, yes, it is one of the best of the Florida rituals to have a sunset salute. And, you know, you don't even have to drink. You just have to understand that you are in a beautiful place and this day should be appreciated.
That's so much like other rituals that, for example, in Michigan, I say that more politics is discussed and decided over breakfast. With the boys and the girls, as we say, than any place else. And as people will sit around at breakfast time around the horseshoe in a restaurant or tables, long tables, and people will sit. It's like in Iowa. You see it at the Iowa political caucuses. People just sit around, and people, politicians, they've got to come there. If they want to find out what the world is thinking, you got to come there. In Britain, that's, you know, the afternoon tea is a ritual. In Vienna, it is the soccer tort at 4 o'clock and a cup of coffee, and just a fascinating ritual. And I was surprised to see that my vague memory of this process was actually true as far as Floridians.
Well, the one thing that bothers me about living in Florida is the longer you live here, the less you go to the ocean. For some reason, the ocean, which I can see outside my window, becomes a place for tourists. And you let that go. And that's the part of Florida that I wish Floridians would learn to go back to the ocean and not just look at it. It's not a postcard. It's something to smell and experience, and we get out of the habit of doing it.
I know exactly what you're saying, because it's a truism that a person can live in London and never be to the Tower of London, can live in Chicago and never be to the top of the Hancock Building or something, be in New York and never go to a play. It is amazing. In fact, I had cousins who lived in Washington who were born and raised there and never went down to the Capitol. And these are well-educated, in other respects, very sophisticated people. They just, you know, they didn't appreciate what they had. And that's what you're describing. Well, you've had some other issues. You've had some health issues also that you've overcome, and I don't know if you would like to talk about that, but I think that it's be helpful to many of the people in our audience.
I did have some health issues. They were going on 8 years ago. I had a series of strokes and a coma and a brain surgery, but the reason what happened to me was so severe at the time was because I was misdiagnosed by a neurologist, and I went to what was billed as one of the 50 best hospitals in the country, and I had a series of really bad migraines and a lot of other symptoms, which now I recognize were obviously the signs of a stroke. And the neurologist on call said to me, "You're too young and fit to have a stroke. Come back for a PET scan on Wednesday." And Wednesday never happened. Not for me. 2 days later, I had a series of strokes and wound up in my husband found me, and I wound up in the hospital with emergency brain surgery. And I was in the hospital for 3 months, and it took 4 years to recover fully. But I've made a full recovery, and I'm back writing. But the message to this that I want to say to people is more women die of strokes than they die of what they really fear, which is breast cancer. Mm-hmm. And we don't know what the signs of the strokes are. We don't know what to do about them. Even doctors get it wrong. So if I had it to do over, and I had enough brain to recognize it, sure, I would have gone to a different ER, but I didn't. And so I lost 4 years with that. But do know the signs of stroke, and do think about it, because it's a killer for men and women.
Well, once again, in tracking your life to this point, you have had the zigs and zags, and the pretty wild zigs and zags that firings and moving around the country and big fired 2-3 times. Good God, you might even begin to feel like they didn't want you, and then the health, all of those things, and you're still writing, and you're still publishing. And your books are interesting. And The Art of Murder is a fascinating book. I enjoyed it a lot. But what is the message? If you've got a message, I mean, you're not finished. So this is only a partial, retrospective. For people who think that they are down and out, and they've been whatever, divorce, death, illness, is there a future?
There is a future, and you can't do it alone. When I had the strokes, I was extremely lucky. I was about to go on tour, and I was extremely lucky because a group of mystery writers got together coast to coast, and they sold my book, which was coming out, and they saved my career. And I recovered from the strokes because I had a very good husband who put up with me while I whined and complained. And I had good doctors, and I had good friends. And survival is a team effort. It's a group effort. You don't do it alone. You have a network of friends, you have a network of family, and that is what will save you. And if they can't, you know, if you've lost your job and you're broke and they can't lend you money, they can give you encouragement. They can give you help. And that is what will get you through.
In a couple of minutes, I'd like to talk about the different kinds of approaches you've taken to writing, because it's not just the dead-end jobs series, but you've got other series of books that you've written, and you mentioned the first one with the reporters, but what else?
I also have a very cozy series called the Josie Marcus Mystery Shopper series, and that is set in my hometown of St. Louis. And a mystery shopper is someone who's hired by a corporation to check the stores to make sure that they're treating their customers right. And so there's 10 books in that series. There's 15 in the Dead End Job series. There's 4 in the Francesca Veerling series. And I'm starting a new series called with Angela Richmond, Death Investigator. And you have death investigators in Michigan. Excuse me, they are hired by, they're actually part of the medical examiner's office, and a death investigator is kind of like a paralegal for the medical examiner. They don't have medical training, but they are trained when there's a crime or an unexplained death to go out to record the body, to record the wounds on the body, to photograph it. And they're sort of there as the arm of the medical examiner. And it's a fascinating profession. And I actually took the training for that at St. Louis University in St. Louis.
When will that be coming out?
That will be August 2nd. It's the first book in the series is called Brainstorm. And the character in there, this is where I get to use my old experience, is a death investigator who suffers a stroke.
Uh-huh.
And the doctor who misdiagnoses her is murdered. I really enjoyed that. And the doctor who saved her life is accused of that murder. And so she has to save the man who saved her. And so, you know, if it's a nice way to kind of round things out after all I was through and work through them, which is writing can be very therapeutic.
We're going to take a break right now, and we'll be right back. We're talking to Elaine Beetz on With Respect. This is John Smetanka, and we'll be, as I say, right back. We're now back on With Respect with Elaine Beetz, who is an author of 30 cozy mysteries. Now, there's also a dark mystery genre, but most of her books have been out in what they call the cozy. As I said, this is John Smetanka. Elaine, when we broke, we started to make a distinction between cozy mysteries and dark mysteries. In the cozy mystery, the sex is down and are downplayed or made humorous. There's not a lot of blood, and there's not the psychopathic killers that you have in, say, Red Dragon or something like that. However, there is a long line of fabulous writers that are considered cozy mystery writers. You mentioned Agatha Christie. Dorothy Sayers is another person who comes to mind with the Lord Peter Wimsey murder cases, murder books in England. And one of the things that they do is they tease out, and you've done this too in this book, you tease out the world around the characters. So it's whether they're giving you a travelogue of the western part of England, or a history of poisons and how they work, or in your case, this book, Fort Lauderdale and its society and its people. That's another interesting part of this genre that I think is very attractive, very interesting.
The cozy mysteries are set in society. It's not like a serial killer comes out of nowhere in a cozy mystery. In the cozy mystery, the mystery, the murder itself, is brought out by some kind of dysfunction in the society. And often the police are not very good at finding out who is the killer. And this is, of course, fiction, but anyway, actually they're very good in real life. But
that's not completely my experience, but go ahead.
In fiction, it is up to the amateur sleuth to start talking to people. And by talking to people, they learn what's not working in their society. And cozies are often read by women who are interested in how to, they're the person in charge of the family, and when something goes wrong, it's their job to make it work, to put it right. And you can't put a murder right, but you can bring justice, and you can get rid of you can bring the killer to justice. So that is the strong appeal of the cozy, and something that all too often we don't get in real life, which is justice.
It's true. That is very true. I've been in the courts so many, now many, many years, and one of the frustrations is, even if you get a positive result for your client, or in the case when I was a prosecutor for the victim and the people, there's often it's not quite fixed, because that victim has to go on and live a life. If it's a violent crime or a crime against their home or something like that, the tendrils of that person's victimization are very deep, and they're very long-lasting, and sometimes they don't surface. The ultimate cleansing does not surface for many years. So it's not that nice, neat thing that you would like to have with it. Some kind of a
you're absolutely right. It's very, very hard. And I used to talk to a homicide cop when I was a reporter, and he said that when a family member is killed, they might as well kill the whole family, because the parents never recover. The brothers and sisters, if it's a child, their life is disrupted. And he said, you just don't murder one person. You've murdered the family.
Doing the flip side, I've also seen families torn apart when their son or daughter has committed the crime.
Mm-hmm.
And they keep asking the question over and over to themselves, what did I do wrong? What did I do wrong? And there is no answer to that. There really isn't an answer to that. I don't know. There's a great satisfaction in seeing justice done, and I can tell you that is a great that was a great privilege of mine to be able to work in a prosecutorial system where I think for the vast majority of the cases we were able to make things work out for everybody, at least somewhat. And however, I saw so many cases, however, when the damage went on for generations. Enough about that particular aspect. So, but the publishing world, are you traveling all around doing your shows?
I am just back from my tour from The Art of Murder. That was 2 weeks, part of it in tornado country.
Uh-huh.
I'm really glad to be back home. But the book has made the Publisher's Alley Mystery Bestseller List, which is, it's been on there for 2.5 weeks in holding, so I'm just crossing my fingers it stays up there for a while.
Now, is that a specific kind of list, a particular type of genre?
It's the independent bookstore's mystery list.
Okay.
And I'm really happy that they're selling my book, and it's doing well, and I hope it stays there for a while.
So what next? What is your next dead end job?
Well, I've just finished a short story for there's a big mystery conference called it's called BoucherCon, and it's in New Orleans. I just finished a short story for an anthology, which is going to benefit the New Orleans Public Library, and the anthology is called Blood on the Bayou, and I've got a short story in that where Helen and my detective and her landlady, Marjorie, go to New Orleans as tourists. And this is new, because when you live in a tourist city and you go into a tourist place, you're a different person, because, you know, everybody wants to come to Fort Lauderdale, and we feel kind of superior as insiders, you know. But here they are in a city with no contacts and no context. So it's a very different mystery for them, and I hope it does well.
I remember telling a friend of mine, the same friend that I mentioned earlier, when I was in London, when I first went to London back in the 70s, I remember in the first few dozen times I was there, it was like a new lover. It was great. It was history. There was mystery. There was society. There was art. There was all of this interesting things that just were very exciting. And then I guess I towed it up. I've now been in London 58 times, and was telling the same friend last year, now walking around London is like seeing an old friend, because I know these places, and they have memories for me, and I have roots there. So there is a difference between, you know, jumping in, seeing, you know, five sites in 3 hours, and flying off to someplace else. As you say, in Florida, when I go down there, I know that I'm not part of that community. And yet, I do pick up a flavor. When I talk to people who are locals, I make it a point to listen to them. I went to a school which was in the bayous, so I'd be fascinated to read about your bayou murder, because I lived in the bayous for a while. That was kind of fun. It was very interesting. It took me 3 years to figure out anything about what it was really like to live in the bayous. So, at any rate, anything else coming out?
Well, let's see. The very first Angela Richman death investigator mystery, which is called Brainstorm, debuts the 2nd of August, and I'm really, really looking forward to that. It's a new direction for me, and I hope you'll enjoy it. It's available for pre-order from Amazon, and it's not gory forensics. It's sort of like Forensic Files, the TV show, without the commercials.
Okay.
So I hope you'll enjoy it. It's getting good advance reviews, and I hope it continues. And I'm working on the next book in that series, which is called Fire and Ashes. And that one's set at a fire. And I think fire is one of our greatest fears of destruction. So mm-hmm. It will be an interesting book for me to write, because I certainly fear the fire.
All right. Elaine Veatz, thank you very much. It's been, unfortunately, we don't have much more time to talk about the wide range of things that you've written about, and I urge my listeners, as usual, to go out and take a look. It's V-I-E-T-S. Do you have a website?
I do, and you can read the first chapters of all my books on the website. It's my name, Elaine, V like in Victor, IETS.com.
All right, there we go. Elaine, thank you very much for your time and a good read.
Well, thank you, John.
The name of our program is With Respect, and we're on every Sunday morning at 7 and every Thursday morning at 10. Until next time, remember our mantra, if you show respect to other people, they will show respect to you.